From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM, Magic and Alchemy, next hour with Rosemary Ellen Guiley, our old friend. Well, just last week, St. Louis was jumping for joy as the St. Louis Cardinals won the World Series. It was great for the city. They even had a huge parade downtown over the weekend. But today, St. Louis has been named the most dangerous city in America. I'm going to explain that in just a second. But a surge in violence made St. Louis the most dangerous city in the country, leading a trend of violent crimes rising much faster in the Midwest than the rest of the nation. The city has long fared poorly in the rankings of the safest and most dangerous American cities compiled by Morgan Quitno Press. Violent crime surged nearly 20% in St. Louis from 2004 to last year, when the rate of the crimes rose more dramatically in the Midwest, according to FBI figures. The ranking, released Monday, came as the city was still celebrating Friday's World Series victory at the new Busch Stadium. St. Louis has been spending millions of dollars on urban renewal, even as the crime rate climbs. Well, you know, as you know, I'm broadcasting in St. Louis right now. And I've been in St. Louis since 1979. Like every major city, there are some areas you don't want to go to. There are some areas that have high crime. One of the reasons why St. Louis has been named the most dangerous city in America is not because it's the most dangerous. It's just that the population of the city now was down to 300-some thousand people. That is it. So when there is serious crime per capita, those percentages are out of sight. That's the main reason why St. Louis has a crime rate that is percentage-wise high per capita, but the city just doesn't have a lot of people anymore. Pakistani troops, backed by missile-firing helicopters, struck a religious school purportedly being used as an al-Qaeda training center, killing 80 people in what appeared to be the country's deadliest ever attack against suspected militants. The country's top Islamic political leader said American planes were used in the pre-dawn strike against the school known as the Madrasa, and called for nationwide protests on Tuesday, claiming all those killed were innocent students and teachers. A U.S. military official denied any involvement in the attack in northwestern Pakistan near the Afghan border. I wonder who they're trying to find. An al-Qaeda-linked militant, who apparently was a primary target of the strike, had left the building a half hour beforehand. Health officials in New York City are stepping up to the plate to remove what is called trans fats from menus at local restaurants. The Board of Health held its first public hearing on a proposal to make New York the first U.S. city to ban restaurants from serving food containing artificial trans fat, ingredients so unhealthy nutritional experts say they belong in the same category as food spoiled by rodent droppings. Some eateries are already scrambling for ways to get trans fats out of their food. Fried chicken restaurant chain KFC said it will switch to soybean oil, a cooking oil with no trans fat, in all U.S. restaurants by April of 2007. But what do we do about now? Eating curry could help prevent rheumatoid arthritis and osteosclerosis, according to a new research. The scientists say turmeric, which is often used in curry, could have a therapeutic effect. Turmeric has been used for centuries in Asian medicine to treat inflammatory disorders, and its extract can be found in Western dietary supplements. An experimental stroke treatment based on the saliva of vampire bats rose from the dead days after a safety panel stalled human testing because of a potential safety risk. An independent panel monitoring clinical trials of the drug said a large study could resume now after last week halting patient recruitment so that it could investigate additional data to evaluate a possible safety issue. I guess now they say it's okay. 80 years after his death, the name Harry Houdini remains synonymous with escape under the most dire circumstances, but Houdini, the immigrant son whose death-defying career made him one of the world's biggest stars, was more than a mere entertainer. A new biography of the legendary performer suggests that Houdini worked as a spy for Scotland Yard, monitored Russian people, and chased counterfeiters for the U.S. Secret Service, all before he was possibly murdered. The Secret Life of Houdini, the making of America's first superhero, releases on Halloween, the anniversary of Houdini's untimely death at the age of 52. In a moment, we'll talk with the two authors, William Kalush and Larry Sloman, on Coast to Coast AM. Two superb guests for you this hour. William Kalush is one of the most respected names in the world of magic. A distinguished writer and lecturer on the history of magic, he is the founder of the Conjuring Arts Research Center and owner of one of the world's most extensive private collections of early and arcane conjuring texts. William Kalush. Hello, William. How are you?
Hello. Good. Thank you.
Good to have you with us. And Larry Sloman is a best-selling and award-winning author and screenwriter. His books include On the Road with Bob Dylan, Reefer Madness, Thin Ice, and Steal This Dream, an oral biography of Abby Hoffman. He is best known for his collaboration with media giant Howard Stern on Private Parts and Miss America. He also worked with magician David Blaine on his memoir, Mysterious Stranger. Sloman's latest project was a collaboration with Red Hot Chili Peppers lead singer Anthony Kiedis on his autobiography, Scar Tissue. He's with us tonight, too, on Coast to Coast. Hello, Larry. How are you?
Hi, George. How you doing?
Good to have both of you with us. Fascinating. I have been a fan of Harry Houdini since I was a child, and just loved everything I could read about him. Loved Tony Curtis playing the part of Harry Houdini in the movie. Tell me a little bit how your research started into basically checking into the life of Harry Houdini. Let's pick that up with you, Larry, if we would.
Well, I met Bill while I was doing the Blaine book with David. Bill has worked with David extensively, David said, "Well, if you want to do the magic history, you got to go to Bill because he's got the most amazing magic library in the world." We started doing the history. We did a chapter on Houdini. I read all the books on Houdini, and there were some real nagging questions. There were some strange career choices he made, and so Bill and I started discussing this, and we say, I think there's a lot more to the story than meets the eye, and Bill actually found a document that propelled us on this whole spy quest. Maybe you can tell about it, Bill.
Okay, Bill, tell us about that.
Well, there was a letter that was floating around out in the world of magic that a friend of Houdini's had written from Glasgow that said there was another escape artist that was claiming Houdini was a spy and that he was a spy for Germany. And it started... It raised questions, but it also kind of put our mind thinking in an interesting direction that also answered some questions, because there had always been these nagging questions about why he made certain choices that weren't obvious. So it got us going, and using lots of new tools, including a database that we actually had to create because it didn't exist and we needed it, called Ask Alexander, we were able to kind of analyze all this information and find new material.
The fact that Harry Houdini, a tremendous escape artist, basically came up from rags to riches, making, what was it, the equivalent of $45,000 a week in today's dollars for what he did?
Right. It's crazy. If you really think about it, we used a conversion technique based on the minimum wage or low skill wages, and he went from starving to and considering quitting the magic world to $45,000 a week, and then he risked everything to go to England with no deals.
Why did he do it?
Well, I mean, that was a red flag for us. And there are Houdini scholars who, even to this day, say, well, there's a story where he goes to Scotland Yard and, the manager of this great theater in London takes him to Scotland Yard and says, if you can get out of these handcuffs from Scotland Yard, I'm going to give you a booking, kid. The story was that he went to London, was just scuffling around for weeks, couldn't get a gig. Absolutely not true. When we looked into the real story, almost within 2 days of arriving in London, he's sitting in the office of the inspector of Scotland Yard, and it's not just any inspector. William Melville, because of this groundbreaking research by an English espionage expert named Andrew Cook. Well, Melville was the chief of intelligence in London at the time. He was a member of special branch, they called it. And Melville's job was really to keep an eye on the anarchist movement, keep an eye on all kind of, you know, what the terrorists of that day. So we, you know, found that Houdini's visit to Melville seems to portend, you know, much more than just a guy going for an audition at a stage show.
Now, who did he spy on when he was doing apparently this?
Well, he was the first thing he did is he repeats this weird pattern of he's got a contract in hand. He goes to England with nothing. He's got a contract in hand in London, and he goes to Germany without a deal and breaks his contract with his old with theater hold owner the manager in London. And then we found that he's sending Melville back reports from Germany where Houdini went. And that seems to be the impetus why he immediately had to go to Germany. And he was sending back information about what he saw in Germany. And it turns out that on several occasions it was material, military material. And at least one circumstance, Melville wrote in his diary that he immediately took it to the War Department.
When did he have the time to spy on people?
Well, it's funny because he only slept 4 hours a night, George, and literally worked the other 20 hours every day for his entire life. And he made, what he did in his life is absolutely astonishing. And spying in those days was different than really intricate missions. That's not really what we're saying he did. What we're saying is that he had an opportunity to take note of what he saw and pass it back to England, which was having trouble keeping track of what the Germans were doing.
I mean, they didn't have agents, per se, at that time.
No, they didn't have it, well, like we have now.
Exactly. There was no CIA, at least for the United States, no CIA, no FBI, nothing.
And MI5 was created while Houdini was doing this. He started out with a special branch and ended up working for MI5.
Okay, so while he's doing this, and he seems to then get contracts, right, to perform his escapism wherever he is, and I don't know whether the government helped in that arena or not, but he was busy, right?
Well, they did help, actually. He got ringing endorsements from Melville. He got ringing endorsements from all the police chiefs in the United States. And, you know, it seems to suggest a quid pro quo. You know, one hand washed the other.
Now, you know, we all know the story that he gets punched in the stomach in Detroit. And
actually Montreal.
In Montreal, but he dies in Detroit, right? Okay.
Right.
You believe that he's been murdered. What happened here?
Well, we're raising the issue that he may have been murdered.
You're not sure, I know that.
We don't say he's actually been murdered, but there's much more to the story of the last few years of his life and his untimely death than meets the eye. You know, the conventional story, again, is that he was punched by a student in Montreal, and they were jostling, and it was all in good fun. Not the case at all. He actually was punched 3 times in Montreal. The first time was by a student, and it was after a speech that he made to the students at McGill University. And he, to demonstrate his power, he said to the student, you can punch me in the stomach. I can withstand any punch, mind over matter. He did that. He was assaulted 2 other times, and those were not such pleasant circumstances. One was by a so-called student, but he really was a 28-year-old guy who worked at a library in McGill, and his name was Whitehead. And these punches were vicious punches delivered in the dressing room after Houdini didn't want to talk to him at all. We think that Whitehead was part of the spiritualist movement. And, you know, to put this whole thing in context, at the end of Houdini's life, he spent the last 2 years of his life fighting phony spiritualists.
He was obsessed with it, wasn't he?
Well, he was, and not because he was a skeptic. I mean, he really wanted to believe. He really wanted to establish contact with his dead parents, for example. every time he would go to a seance and see a medium, he detected the trickery in them. And a lot of these mediums were taking people for a lot of money. It was a real social problem at the time. And Houdini began a crusade, and he actually formed what he called My Own Secret Service. And it was an amazing group of people. He had showgirls go in as undercover agents to seances, take notes, mock the building. He then would go in later with the police in disguise. In the middle of the seance, he would turn on the lights. He would expose the medium. They would say, "Who are you?" He'd rip off his mask. He'd say, "I am Houdini." And this is when the guy is at the height of his power. This would be like Madonna going into something and saying,
But they would arrest these people, right? These people would be arrested then, I guess, on the spot.
Right. And sometimes he would even turn and convert the people that he arrested and use them as undercover agents to spy on other mediums.
So this must have been huge business in those days.
Was very tremendous amount of money was there.
And he was going after what was in essence an organized crime ring. They weren't just mom and pop shops ripping off a few kind of credulous people.
Yeah,
they would find somebody who would buy into it and then take them for as much as they could, and then they'd sell their names to other people, just like con artists today do. And but it's interesting though that our circumstantial evidence about perhaps there's a murder here is really based on the idea that the punches couldn't have killed him. You know, the general wisdom is that these punches caused traumatic appendicitis, which led to peritonitis, which killed him. And the truth is, George, that traumatic appendicitis doesn't exist. It's never existed. There's no such thing.
See, the movie got us thinking that way.
Right. And, well, there's the punches, though. I mean, in fact, his five doctors, after he died, to help his widow with the insurance claim, wrote out affidavits that said, well, you know, the real honest one said, I've never seen a case of traumatic appendicitis, but that's what I'm pretty sure is happening here.
Yeah, okay.
And everybody we've talked to, and you can try this too, you can talk to any trauma doctor you know and ask if they've ever seen it, and they've never seen it because it doesn't exist. But what we looked at is, again, a series of circumstances that didn't make sense if you put them all in context. And what we found was that the organized crime circuit of spiritualists were making huge threats, but he was also getting threatened by Marjorie and her husband. Marjorie was the biggest medium in the country at the time, and she wasn't doing it for money. They were already wealthy. They were doing it for this kind of social prestige.
Right, okay.
And the husband was a really shady guy. And Larry found the most amazing archive of material ever uncovered. Nobody's ever seen it literally since Dr. Crandon, her shady husband, put this stuff in the closet. It sat there until he found it. Tell the story.
What was this? Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Well, you know, as part of our research 2 years ago, I went to a Houdini seance. And at the Houdini seance, I met the granddaughter of Marjorie. And, you know, Marjorie was Houdini's nemesis. She was going for the Scientific American Prize. They were going to award $10,000. You know, Houdini exposed her. I called Marjorie's granddaughter. I said, I'd love to interview you for the book. She said, come on to my house. I live near you in Long Island. We went out to the house. She fed us. It was beautiful. We interviewed her, and then I said, you wouldn't have any letters or papers lying around. And she said, as a matter of fact, I do. You know, I have great letters from Arthur Conan Doyle to Marjorie's husband. I have letters from Oliver Lodge. I have incredible letters. William Butler Yeats was writing Marjorie. It was incredible. So she says, let me show you. She goes into the spare bedroom, opens up the door. The closet is filled with box after box of correspondence and scrapbooks. Scrapbooks that Dr. Crandon actually made of everything that Marjorie had done from the beginning. And this was thousands and thousands of pages. She let the granddaughter let us copy all of them, put them into the database, and we started looking into this thing, and we found connections between Doyle and the Crandons that were much more extensive than anybody knew. We started finding other shady characters who were involved with Marjorie, including a guy named Joe DeWickoff, who wrote a letter while Houdini was on his deathbed that I showed it to Marjorie's great-granddaughter. I said, look at this letter. What do you think? And she goes, this is like a mea culpa, acknowledging that he may have had something to do with killing Houdini.
Oh,
I mean, it was just incredible material.
That's a great choice. Stay with us, both of you. We're going to take some phone calls as we continue this dialogue about Houdini and some of the things that really happened to him, things we really don't know about. He was considered a superhero. Why? We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. This hour, we're talking about the secret life of Houdini with our two guests, Larry Sloman and William Kalush. Their new book out on Halloween, so get ready for that one. Hey, hundreds, and I mean hundreds of double CDs are going to go out from last week, and we expect more of the same this week. That's what we're doing. A long time ago, we gave out a CD with an After Dark subscription called Perfect Possession. It was the great interview with the late Father Malachi Martin. Well, we found another great interview that Art Bell did years ago, and we're going to give you both CDs with an After Dark subscription. Perfect Possession 1 and 2, classic Art Bell and classic Father Malachi Martin. You can call 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505. Or you can go online at coasttocoastam.com. We're with Larry Sloman and William Kalush, authors of the book, The Secret Life of Houdini. Why does it seem that Houdini was a superhero then, and he's definitely still a superhero now, Bill?
Well, by 1919, Houdini's name had entered the language. He had become a Superman in the Nietzsche sort of Übermensch meaning. He had become bigger than a regular person because he couldn't be defeated. He'd had a 20-year career at that point and had never failed in a challenge. At least no one knew if he'd ever failed.
Right.
The myth was that he hadn't. So he'd achieved Superman status. And what he did, instead of retiring, or which he was tired and he really wanted to retire, he was worn out, he turned all that energy, money, knowledge, etc., into good for the public. He became a public advocate against fraudulent spiritualists. And that is what we mean by a superhero. He didn't just kind of be a selfish Superman and retire with it. He really helped a lot of people.
Was he loved during this time period?
Loved by the people in general?
By the people, yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And he still is. You know, there's a faction of magicians that try to revise what was really going on and saying, well, he's not really famous. He became famous afterward, which is just utter nonsense. He was extremely famous. He was in thousands and thousands and thousands of newspapers.
You know, go back and read all those clips. And the newspapers like the New York Herald Tribune and Times were actually writing editorials lauding him as an example of what sort of people who achieve fame should do, that he was really a public defender. That's the way they conceived him. And whenever he went into a city and he'd play a city, every day he made the front page banner headlines. Houdini exposes this medium. Houdini does this. And it was an unbelievable fame.
What was the wildest or craziest stunt he ever performed?
I would have to say, Bill, and you'd probably agree, right? When, you know, he used to do a very beautiful trick, and it was a very simple, small piece of magic where he would swallow pins and he would chew
needles,
them.
Sewing needles.
Yeah.
Big, vicious, sharp sewing needles. He'd swallow a whole package of them.
Right.
Sometimes several packages.
Right. And then swallow thread and then take them out.
Well, then he would swallow both, then the thread would pop out of his mouth, and he'd pull it, and threaded every foot or so was a needle, and he'd pull it all the way across the stage. And he had the charisma to do this on stages like the New York Hippodrome, which is gone now, but it was a 5,600-seat theater.
Which is huge,
huge
for those days.
You could barely see a person, and he had the charisma to pull this thing off with needles and thread.
Was he sleight of hand, or was he really doing some strange things here?
Well, it was sleight of hand. It wasn't real magic, but it was so good that to this day no one knows precisely what he did.
But what he really did, he
varied this sometimes, and that's what we're getting to. Go ahead.
But when he did it once before an audience, mostly of doctors, at the Boston Athletic Club. And before he actually ate the needles, he gave, there were 37 needles. He gave one to different people in the audience, and they came up, and he said, put them anywhere in my face you want.
Like acupuncture almost, huh?
What, yeah. Like a human porcupine.
Yeah.
One by one, they just put these needles in his face.
He had a high pain threshold, I guess.
Oh, it was unbelievable. And he ended up with 27 needles in his face, every place but his eyes. And he took them out, and he put them in his mouth and swallowed them all, swallowed 27 feet of thread and regurgitated it and pulled it across the room. Jeez. And it was just, he stunned these guys.
How would you compare him, Bill, with David Blaine now, who's done some incredible things?
Well, it's an interesting thing. And we say in the beginning of the book that David, in some ways, is he's the heir to part of the Houdini mantle. And I'll tell you exactly what I think is the connection between he and David Blaine.
Maybe he's the reincarnated.
Perhaps. You know, Blaine was born in early April, 100 years after. Now, Houdini thought he was born in 1873. He claimed he was born April 6, 1873. And Blaine was born April 4th, 1973.
Well, you never know.
Houdini later changed it to 74. Based on better information from his mother, but he really thought he was born in 73.
Right.
How did any of us know? But the real connection to Blaine is that Houdini got to his audience on an emotional level. They came there to see he's a human, but is he going to survive this event? Okay, it's more than a trick. It's never a trick. And Blaine, when he does those stunts, and there are magicians that say, hey, this isn't magic, and there are magicians that say, hey, what Houdini did wasn't magic, and I reject both of those. I think it's absolutely both of them are magic. But I've done these stunts with Blaine since the first one, and I know that he's connecting on an emotional level with the people that come to see it.
I agree. I just saw, as a matter of fact, last night, something on either one of the cable networks of his New York bit where he was in a water ball.
Oh, I've heard. I haven't seen the recut of it. He cut it from the two-hour kind of fluffy live network version to a really tight hour.
Oh, it was incredible.
And I've heard that it's incredible.
Coming
I missed
out.
It, though.
Yeah, it was something. Let's take a few calls while we continue to talk about Harry Houdini. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. It's me, Tim from L.A.
Hey, Tim. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Good.
Thank you. Either Bill or Ratso, I got a question I'd like to ask about Houdini. And my question is...
Ratso? Who's Ratso? Is that a nickname?
That's Larry's nickname.
All right.
And Bill's my nickname.
Okay, the question is there any truth to the rumor that Houdini said to his wife on his deathbed that he will try to contact her by saying a code word? And do any of you know that code word? And I'll hear the answer on the radio. Thank you very much.
All right. I've heard about this. Do either one of you know this?
Well, yes, we do.
Uh-huh.
And it
Houdini
is
actually made many pacts with many of his friends that whoever would predecease the other would try to make contact. That's the way he believed that contact could be made. He didn't necessarily think you had to make contact through a medium because he basically didn't trust any of these mediums because he would find out they were fraudulent. He could see right through them. Whether he had now Bess, his wife, of course, claims that she did have a pact with him, although it was not known during his life whether he did. What happened after his death is very interesting, because as soon as he died, Arthur Conan Doyle, who really was the worldwide leader of this spiritualist movement, and in a way saw himself as a messiah. I mean, he really believed that the world was coming to an end and that he was going to be the man, the bridge between the spirit world and the world of the flesh. Conan Doyle immediately went to work on Bess Houdini, the widow, trying to steer her to mediums of his choice in New York, trying to get her to go along with the spiritualist program, which was that Houdini is going to come back and give you this message. He even went so far as a protege of his, a minister, came to New York and began to have what seems to be a love affair with Bess, and manipulates her into a seance where Houdini comes back, reveals a code, and then says that there is no death. You guys were right all along. I was wrong while I was on the earth. The whole thing was a charade, but people did believe it at the time, and there were huge headlines. Houdini comes back.
I wanted to believe it now. Are you going to give us a code? Or do we have to read the book?
You're going to have to read the book, and there's probably a code in the book, too, George.
Is it just one word, or is it like a phrase?
It's a phrase.
It's a phrase.
All right.
And there's evidence that shows that it's probably made up by Bess.
Right.
Interesting.
It's interesting because he had so many pacts with so many other people, but there's not any evidence that we found that he actually had a pact with his own wife. But he also told his doctors when he's in the hospital, in Grace Hospital, he pointed at her and said, "She's the most, don't let that woman in my room. She's the most peculiar person I've ever known."
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there. Where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm calling from Nassau County, Long Island.
Sure thing, sir. Go ahead.
I graduated from Appleton, Wisconsin, from Lawrence University, and Houdini lived there as a child because his father was the first rabbi of a temple in Appleton, Wisconsin,
right,
and was later then fired because he spoke too much in German. And I believe Houdini's last name was Weiss. And I don't know if he lived long enough to know about the anti-Semitism growing in Europe at the time in the 20s, which that's when it started, and why he didn't react to that. And that's what I want to ask your
interesting guest. Question. Okay, Larry or Bill, aware of this one?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's really interesting because he didn't come across any sort of anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic feelings in America that we're aware of. And he was in Appleton, which was a very liberal town because of Lawrence University, and like your caller said, he's absolutely right, his father, Rabbi Weiss, who wasn't a rabbi until he came to Appleton, and they needed a rabbi, so he said, "I'll be a rabbi."
Poof, he's
a pragmatic guy. There was no sort of class system that Houdini ever perceived. And when he went to Europe, he did perceive this. It wasn't as strong as it became in the 20s, but the Russians were so overt about it that it was against the law for a Jew to sleep in Moscow. And he also mysteriously overcame this. How he was allowed to enter Moscow and sleep in Moscow, we're not quite certain. It might have had something to do with his connections to Melville and Melville's connection to the Okhrana.
And didn't the Tsar like him, too?
The Tsar liked him very much. There's a great story about what the Tsar wanted him to do for him. Do you want to tell that, Larry?
Yeah, what happened?
Sure. Well, Houdini would do such mysterious, miraculous things. Like one of the things he did for the Tsar at a private party for the Tsar was to make the bells of the Kremlin ring that hadn't rung in 100 years. And they say, "There's no way you could do this." And
right.
He said, "Oh, well, sure, watch." And he went to the window, and he makes some gestures at the window, and all of a sudden, they heard the bells of the Kremlin ring. Now, the Tsar and the Tsarina are convinced now that Houdini has mystical powers, and they want Houdini to be an advisor to them. Ultimately, I mean, of course he said no. Ultimately, they found Rasputin. And in fact, we have evidence that they came back to Houdini later and said, get rid of this Rasputin guy. Come back. And we want you back.
We want you.
But, you know, getting back to the anti-Semitism thing, you know, Houdini was very greatly moved by what he saw in Russia, by the pogroms. And in fact, his whole celebrity advocacy thing really, I think, was inspired a little bit by Sarah Bernhardt, the great actress, who was one of the first people to speak out against Russian anti-Semitism.
Right.
And Houdini writes in his column, Dramatic Mirror, talks about that, talks about the horrors that he saw. He was very shocked by what he saw in Russia in terms of the way they treated the Jews.
What a man he would have been today.
Unbelievable.
It would have been unbelievable. He was really so far ahead of his time. He was an amazing template for what the 20th century became in many ways.
You know, and talk about charitable things. And a lot of this, I think, is obviously instilled by his father, the rabbi. But, you know, Houdini was such a soft touch. Any magician who was stranded and ran out of money, he would wire them money so they could get home and bring their equipment home.
He'd bail them out.
You know, we didn't
not just magicians. Anybody.
Right.
He started out in a necktie cutting factory working for nothing, okay? And he was a hardworking kid.
Yeah.
He made some money, but he just started to make a little money. He'd just gotten in out of the rain himself. And we found this amazing letter that I don't think any other Houdini guy has ever pointed out, where the old man that sat next to him at the necktie cutting company had kind of gotten screwed out of his pension, which was a whopping $5 a week.
Yeah.
And Houdini, barely making it himself, is sending the guy his pension.
Out of his own pocket.
Out of his own pocket, just because it's what he should do.
You know, and there's a great story we'd even put in the book, but near the end of his life, Houdini's walking down the street, and this old, feeble man comes up to him and says, Mr. Houdini, thank you so much. Oh, thank you, thank you. He says, well, what are you thanking me for? He goes, you've been supporting me for the last 5 years. he didn't even know. He couldn't keep track of how much money he was giving out.
Just
to people.
Giving it out. That's amazing. First time caller.
He was giving gold coins to the soldiers.
What a remarkable guy.
I mean, it was just, he was incredibly charitable. And with his time as well, I mean, we could have put 20 photographs of Houdini doing parties for crippled children and children in hospitals in our book if we'd had more room. And we put a few in, but it's remarkable. He never seemed to run out of time to do something for somebody else.
Well, he understood that you had to give back. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Melanie calling from Schaumburg, Illinois.
Hey, Melanie. I've got a couple minutes for you, so go ahead.
Hi. Well, gentlemen, I have the book right in front of me, and I'm already in Chapter 9. That's how much I've enjoyed it so far.
Oh, great.
And I wanted to ask you, I'm assuming you went through Houdini's personal papers, and I was wondering if you found anything regarding the spy business in any of his papers?
Well,
she missed a little bit of the top of the interview, but very quickly rehash that if you
want. It's a slightly different question. It's were there things relevant to the spying in his personal papers? And no, there aren't letters that say specifically I was spying. There are things where he's got somebody very close to where you live in Chicago, Berwyn, a man named Montreville Wood, who is a genius, who is a secret sort of helper to Houdini, who's building all sorts of apparatus, later builds some flying apparatus for Houdini and for the government. And Houdini really reprimands him for opening his mouth about some of the things Houdini's doing. So there are hints, but we also know that letters that in Houdini's private papers, which many of which are held at the University of Texas at Austin, have been cleaned up at some point, because we know of affairs that he had where there should have been letters, where we found the other sides of the letters, Houdini's side, in other collections.
And we also know that Houdini's brother, Hardin, after Houdini's death, burnt a lot of personal papers.
He burned so many papers, he almost burned his own house down.
Oh, what a shame. What a shame. Name of the book, The Secret Life of Houdini. I assume it's out now. I thought it was just starting to come out on Halloween, so she must have an advanced copy, or she's already at the stores, huh?
Well, it's been 2 hours now. Maybe she's just had it for 2 hours, and she's burned through 9 chapters.
The lines are starting to form at bookstores all around the country.
Right.
Hey, good luck to both of you. The Secret Life of Houdini. It's in major bookstores, Amazon.com. Thank you.
Thank you, George.
We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with Rosemary Ellen Guiley as we continue our magic and alchemy theme tonight on Coast to Coast AM.